This is Gulf Coast Live Arts Edition from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The Punta Gorda Symphony's classical concert series concludes this Sunday evening with a program that will feature American composer, conductor, and educator Kenneth Fuchs' piano concerto, Spiritualist. Pianist Jeffrey Beagle will be the featured soloist for the performance. The world premiere recording of this piano concerto under the Naxos label with the London Symphony Orchestra under conductor Joanne Folletta won the 2018 Grammy Award for Best Classical Compendium. That recording also included pianist Jeffrey Beagle. A previous album, including compositions by Fuchs, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, also received two Grammy nominations. Fuchs is a prolific composer, writing music for orchestras, wind ensembles, chamber ensembles, choral groups, and even musical theater. He's a sought-after composer for commissioned works, and he's gained global recognition through performances, digital streaming, and downloads of his music throughout the world. Fuchs is also a dedicated educator, serving as professor of music composition at the University of Connecticut. He received his Bachelor of Music degree in composition from the University of Miami and his Master and Doctor of Musical Arts degrees in composition from the prestigious Juilliard School. He's also dedicated to arts administration, having served in administrative roles in schools such as the Manhattan School of Music and the Juilliard School, among others. He also previously served as a member of the Commission on Accreditation for the National Association of Schools of Music, helping to guide the music curricula at institutions of higher learning throughout the country. Ahead of Sunday night's performance by the Punta Gorda Symphony Orchestra, we're sitting down with the composer himself, Ken Fuchs. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live Arts Edition, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be with you and to have an opportunity to share my music with your audiences.
And to engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation or any of our shows, find us on Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. Now, Ken, I always like to start at the beginning. Tell me about your early music influences. Did you grow up in a home environment where music appreciation was particularly valued and emphasized?
I grew up in a home where my interests in music were certainly encouraged. And I actually grew up in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, and my first connection to music at the age of 10 was starting with piano lessons and singing in our church choir, and then in the choruses in the schools that I attended, middle school and high school. So my first connection with music was through voice, and the sense of vocal utterance has always been so clear in my music, the sense of lyrical singing through the instrument. And once I entered high school, Piper High School in Sunrise, Florida, I was blessed to have a wonderfully supportive band director, Dr. Bentley Schellehammer, who truly set my foot on the path toward becoming a professional composer. He encouraged me to write music for the band, and the most important thing that he said was, "I will play everything that you write." And he did. And that's how I learned to compose music at an early age before starting undergraduate studies at the University of Miami School of Music.
Wow, what a great supporter and patron to have so early on. That's fantastic. How did you approach writing compositions, particularly for instruments, you know, with a background that involved like piano lessons? I guess what I'm getting at is how well-versed in the instruments you're writing for do you need to be as the composer?
Well, when I was starting to compose original music, Dr. Schellehammer, I will never forget one of our first encounters when I said to him that I was interested in composing music. We were playing a few pieces in the band that I really liked, and I thought, you know, I think I could do that, and I would really like to try it. And when I told that to him, the first thing he did was write out the ranges of each of the instruments of the band for me on a piece of music paper. And in fact, I still have that piece of paper. But the important thing was, while I was trying to sketch out and write down my own musical ideas, I had started acquiring scores of pieces for band that I really liked, and I was very serious about studying those works, not only listening to them through recording, but sitting at the piano and playing through them to try and understand what the composer was trying to do musically and how the composer achieved the sounds that I liked, the how the chord sounded, the chord voicing, and what instruments he chose for each of the chords and the melodies. And I spent a lot of time kind of getting under the hood of a few pieces that I really liked. And that's how I developed a sense of conceiving music for a larger ensemble and a diverse group of wind, brass, and percussion instruments.
That's really interesting. I'm drawing from my own experience. I was fortunate enough in high school to get to attend a performing arts magnet school. So I, took some pretty high level music theory courses, and they were always engaging and very challenging. But it's sort of where I realized I did not want to be a composer. There's a lot of, analytics and a lot of, it seems like, left brain activity completely mixed with the creative process.
Well, I think, the first thing for me was I did have a talent for it, and I sensed it, but I didn't perhaps know quite what it was. But, to have a teacher who knew how to draw that out and suggest ways of thinking about things and ways of just how to proceed and move forward with studying music so that I might get a sense of what composition is and understand how other composers achieved what they wanted to in terms of writing original music. I think that was the most important thing that happened to me, was to have a teacher who genuinely encouraged me and also played my music. In fact, that is one of the things that I say so often to my students at UConn. When you finish this piece that we're working on, the first thing that you have to do is go find a group of players to play through it for you so that you can hear it with acoustic instruments and try and understand if the choices you made are the right ones, if you're hearing the sounds that you thought you were going to hear, and if not, why not? And have the players help you to understand what your piece is about. And then you see what it's like for players to actually try and play the piece. And does the music lie well for the instruments? Is the music idiomatically composed for each of the instruments? So it's a process that a composer has to follow through from not only thinking about the piece and writing it down, but being sure that a composer hears it as soon as possible after they write it. And I think that is the greatest gift that Dr. Schellhammer gave to me at a very young age. I was a junior in high school.
Wow, yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, switching gears a little bit, Jeffrey Beagle, who will be the featured soloist at Sunday's Pornogorda Symphony Concert, was also the pianist in the Grammy-winning recording album of this piano concerto with the London Symphony Orchestra. And I was looking ahead at the schedule and seeing that in April, Beagle will also be performing this in a series of concerts with the Space Coast Symphony. Tell me about your working relationship with Beagle, because it seems like you work together pretty well.
I've always said the greatest friendships are those made in music. And Jeffrey Beagle and I were classmates at Juilliard in the 1980s. And in fact, Joanne Folletta was also my classmate. And Jeffrey and Joanne and I knew each other. That's how we met in music. And Jeffrey and I became good friends. He is such a remarkable pianist and was so successful at an early age when he was still in school. And I remember attending his debut recitals in New York City, and he received such wonderful, five-star reviews from the New York Times for his debut recital. And we just hit it off. I loved his piano playing, and he liked the kind of music that I was beginning to write. And he always said, someday we have to work together. And I said, of course, we will. And what is so important is that you stay in touch with your colleagues. I tell my students, you, the person sitting next to you, you are the future of music. And that was certainly what I felt when I was at Juilliard with Jeffrey and Joanne and other friends. So Jeffrey, fast forwarding now 20 years, maybe 15, 18, 20 years, Jeffrey contacted me and said, I've just formed a new piano trio called Trio 21, and we're doing a debut concert in New York. Would you consider writing a piano trio for us? And I said, of course, I we've been talking about this for years. And Jeffrey, aside from being a remarkable pianist, he truly understands the entrepreneurial aspects of being a musician. And he has spent his career commissioning many celebrated composers, American composers, to write concerti for him and also chamber music. And he understands that it's important to raise money to commission composers and to find performances and to genuinely promote the works. So I wrote the piano trio for him. It's called Falling Trio, and we premiered it in 2011. And then he said, you know, it's time for the concerto. And I said, I think it is too. And in the meantime, over the course of a few years, thinking about Jeffrey and the piece I might want to write for him, I had been making a few sketches for an eventual piano concerto over the course of about 10 years. So when we decided to get started on the piece, I took out the sketches and looked at them, and I was amazed at how relevant they still seemed to the kind of piece that I wanted to compose for Jeffrey. So he found two orchestras to commission the piece along with several other donors, and I wrote the concerto for him, and he gave the premiere with the Springfield Symphony in Springfield, Massachusetts, conducted by Kevin Rhodes in March of 2016. And, you know, in the meantime, Joanne and I had stayed in touch. She gave the first performance of one of my pieces at Juilliard at a contemporary concert in 1985, and we stayed in touch, and in September of 2003, I contacted her about would she be interested in recording an album of my orchestral works, and she said absolutely yes, and she had some dates lined up with the London Symphony Orchestra already, and we went to the LSO and saw if we could schedule our recording sessions and so forth, and it all worked out beautifully. And 6 months later, having to raise the money for the recording, we were in London recording with the LSO, and that was our first of five recordings together. And the recording was released in August of 2005, and it was nominated for two Grammy Awards. So we, you know, all of these friendships, they intertwined through the years, and I've understood that. So I'm very, very grateful to have the friendship of Jeffrey and Joanne and friends who have believed in my music and supported it over many years.
What a great story. That's so remarkable that you were classmates all those years ago. Well, with all of your commitments currently in academia, is it a challenge for you to find, you know, the time you need to really isolate yourself and create new compositions when you want to?
Well, when I was at Juilliard, I had the extraordinary privilege of studying with several of the great American composers of the 20th century. My principal teacher was Vincent Persichetti and also David Diamond, two of the great symphonists of the mid-20th century American school. But I also studied with Milton Babbitt, who was a celebrated serial composer. And in addition to those three men, the faculty also included Elliot Carter and Roger Sessions, and the president of the school was Peter Menon. So this was really the last decade of the great generation of American symphonists and modernists who were teaching. And when I was there, Peter Menon, as I said, was president of the school. His predecessor was William Schumann, another great American symphonist who went on to be the first president of Lincoln Center. And I thought, you know, I'd like to do that with my life, too. I want to be a composer and run a music school, as many other composers had through the 20th century, including Howard Hanson at the Eastman School of Music and Gunther Schuller at New England Conservatory. So I spent a number of years, almost 20 years, actually, as a dean or a director of three different schools of music, and I was composing at the same time. And as you might imagine, it takes a lot of energy and focus to run a school of music and then go home at night and compose music. But in 2005, after 20 years of doing that, I thought, you know, that's enough. I could just tell that I really, if I had to choose one thing and if I had energy enough for one thing, it would be composing. So I had served as head of the Department of Music at the University of Connecticut for 3 years, and I finally stepped away from administration, and since then I've happily been teaching composition and composing, teaching and composing full-time for the last 15 years, and it's been a wonderful chapter, very liberating chapter of my life.
How would you characterize your approach to composing new works? And by that I mean, are you the disciplined type who needs to regularly set aside time to write, or do you find you're more productive if, you know, you wait for the muse of inspiration to strike?
Well, composing is a bit like practicing your instrument. I've always felt you have to do it every day, and something really important has to be going on in my life if I'm not composing at some point during the day, every day. So that's important to me. It's nearly an emotional need as much as a musical pleasure. I have to compose. I'm really not happy if I'm not creating music. So, you know, I love to listen to music that I haven't heard before. I still study musical scores. I still go to the piano to, as I said earlier, to get under the hood of pieces that I don't know, to just see what composers are thinking and how they achieve the sounds that they achieve. And that's always interesting to me. But, I look at them and listen, but I kind of then put it aside just to, not so much to copy them, certainly, but just to sort of stay current with what's happening. And, where does music come, where does music composition come from? I do hear it in my head. And even at the beginning of a piece, I, have a sense of either a shape of the piece in my mind or a sound or even just a few chords that appear in my ear, and I go to the piano and I sketch. I take a pencil and a piece of manuscript paper, and for several weeks I'll just write down every day musical ideas, melodic ideas, harmonic ideas, and each day when I go to the keyboard, there's always a response. I'll look at what I did the day before and say, "Ugh, I really don't like that," and try and keep going, or, the reaction will be, I think that works, and I'll take that and try and develop it and move it forward. And that process of just kind of almost free associating with what I'm hearing in my head goes on for a couple of weeks. And as always, there comes a moment when I'm sketching ideas for a new piece, whether at that point I know if it's going to be a piece for orchestra or band or string quartet, because usually everything I write now is for a particular ensemble or soloist. So, there's always a point where I think I have enough material to go to the score. Most composers work at the computer with music notation software, and I take the musical ideas that I've sketched, and I really begin composing directly into the score. And that's how it happens, and it's a process of maybe 6 to 8 weeks.
All right. Started. If you're just joining the show, we're speaking with composer and conductor Kenneth Fuchs. His piano concerto, Spiritualist, will be performed this Sunday evening by the Punagorda Symphony in a performance featuring pianist Jeffrey Beagle. If you'd like to comment on our conversation or engage with fellow listeners, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Now, your compositions include vocal pieces, as I mentioned earlier, in which the lyrics come from the works of poets like Robert Frost or Richard Wilbur, or even Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lanford Wilson. Can you contrast for me writing those sorts of compositions where ideas and themes are being provided for you in words versus writing a completely independent composition where the sense of emotions conveyed through the piece are entirely yours to create and shape?
When I was growing up, as I mentioned, when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I was taking piano lessons, and the first music that I was really exposed to was the American Popular Songbook, the great scores and songs of the cornerstone composers, Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, George Gershwin, Richard Rodgers, and Cole Porter. And I grew to genuinely love that music. And while I was taking piano lessons, I sought out songs by those composers and was trying to play through them at the piano. So I was getting a sense of their individual compositional style. But then, when I discovered Leonard Bernstein, whose music, of course, I adore. You know, when I came across West Side Story and Candide and On the Town and Wonderful Town, there's a sense of it. And at the same time, I discovered, too, that there he was on CBS television delivering his Young People's Concerts with the New York Philharmonic. I think that was the doorway between my early influences with the great Broadway scores, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Frank Lesser and others, Julie Stein and Harold Arlen. But, you know, Bernstein was kind of a door to Aaron Copland because, of course, he was a great champion of Aaron Copland's music. And I was beginning to get a sense of and a real feel for and love of what we know as the American Symphonic School. And Bernstein championed so many composers of that school, not only Copland and Gershwin, but Walter Piston and Ned Roram and David Diamond. And this was a whole world to me that was somehow connected to the American vernacular that I had been listening to so with such eager enthusiasm and anticipation through all those wonderful songs. So when I arrived at the first LP, classical LP that I ever bought in high school, it was an LP of Aaron Copland conducting his music with the London Symphony Orchestra. Back then, for CBS Records, for Columbia Records, he actually recorded the bulk of his symphonic catalog with the LSO for Columbia. And so this first LP had Copland conducting Fanfare for the Common Man and Lincoln Portrait, narrated by Henry Fonda, and Appalachian Spring. And John, I will tell you, when I listened to that recording for the first time, when it was finished, I said, that's what I want to do with my life. I want to write music that sounds like that, or I want to write music that is inspired by that. I love this music. I want to live in this sound world. And, oh, what an incredible joy and honor and privilege it would be to have my music recorded by the London Symphony Orchestra. So here I am, almost 50 years later, having recorded 5 albums of my music with the LSO. Oh,
wonderful, wonderful. In the lead up to a concert like Sundays with the Punagorda Symphony, tell me about any collaborative work you do with the conductor and the orchestra to help guide their interpretation of your work, because it just seems like such a wonderful advantage to have access to the composer as opposed to performing a piece written by, say, Dvorak, who's been dead for more than 100 years. I mean, yes, we have the piece and there's decades of past performances to draw from, but it's just really not the same as being able to access the actual composer.
There's nothing more thrilling for me as a composer than, of course, to hear my music played live by an orchestra and with a soloist, but to have the opportunity to collaborate with the soloist and the conductor on the interpretive ideas of the piece. Because as you can well imagine, as your listeners can imagine, a performance from one conductor to the next can be quite different. The details, the conductor's conception of the piece can be really quite different. And so I really look forward to that and cherish that because I learn from that. I learn about my own music, how it's perceived by the conductor and the players and how they interpret it. And, you know, the way they shape a phrase or the kinds of tempi that they might take in a piece that I hadn't really considered before. It might be faster. In some cases, it could be slower, and I've experienced both, and it's been revelatory to me. So I am so grateful to have the opportunity to come to the Puntagorda Symphony and work with Raffaele Ponti and my friend of almost 45 years, Jeffrey Beagle. It's going to be a very special occasion, and I'm really looking forward to working with them.
All right. Well, let's delve into the piano concerto a bit itself. Can you tell me about what inspired the title, Spiritualist?
Well, the piano concerto is based on 3 paintings by the abstract expressionist painter Helen Frankenthaler. And Helen grew up as kind of the second generation of abstract expressionist painters in the United States. In the 1940s, the New York School of Painting, the School of Abstract Expressionism, emerged in New York City. And the principal painters of the movement at the beginning were Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko, Robert Motherwell, Franz Klein, and the sculptor David Smith. And Helen came along a few years later. She was younger than those painters by maybe 8 to 10 or 12 years. And Helen brought forward from that stylistic point of view a use of color in her paintings that the earlier painters hadn't really employed. And for our listeners who, for instance, know the work of Jackson Pollock, you might call them the famous drip paintings. And Pollock had a very unique working method of having a large canvas on the floor of a studio and dripping and staining the canvas with different colors and shades of enamel paint. But they were mostly subdued hues of gray and ochre and black and blue and brown. And Helen took that concept and in the early 1950s began to take the painting, the pigment of the paint, and dilute it with turpentine so it became much looser, almost like a juice. And she would lay unprimed canvas, meaning not prepared at all with anything on top of it, just the raw canvas. She would lay that huge piece of canvas on her floor and work in the same method as Pollock, dancing around the canvas and pouring and spattering the paint. But because she was using a diluted type of pigment, it created a kind of a soaking, staining into the canvas technique that the others really hadn't employed. And it was really quite unique. And the first painting, her breakthrough painting in 1952, which was called Mountains and Sea, became like her first important picture. So here I am in New York in the early 80s, studying at Juilliard and freshly arrived from Florida and had written quite a bit of music for band and a little bit for strings and lucky enough to be in this incredibly heady environment of the composers I mentioned at the school, but still in an atmosphere where the kind of music that I write today, what we might call tonally based, emotionally accessible, but you know, direct, tuneful, that was not really accepted. It wasn't really happening much in the early 80s, and I knew that was the kind of music I wanted to write, the music that I had grown up loving. Aaron Copland, the ballets of Aaron Copland, and the lyrical symphonic statements of all the composers that we've discussed. So I saw Helen's work first on a television documentary, my little black and white TV in my New York apartment, and I was so struck by her working method and the way she articulated how she worked. As she said, once you absorb the rules, once you have gained a sense of technique, to move forward, it's not that you want to constrain yourself by working in a style or a form that's already been achieved, but to, as she said, throw it all out, to depend on your sense of intuition, your emotional response, the feeling that you want to express in the work, and in her case, expressing a state of feeling and emotion through the gestures that she was putting on the canvas. And I intuitively understood what she was doing because I knew that's what I wanted to do in my own music. So I wrote her a letter. She lived in New York on East 94th Street, and I was living on West 71st Street, just a few blocks from Juilliard, and wrote her a very serious letter about her work and expressing why I admired it and what I thought, what I perceived she was trying to do. And quite unbelievably, within a week, she wrote back to me. I was astonished that someone so famous would be interested in anything that I had to say. But she did. She took it seriously, and she invited me to an opening of a show that she was going to have, about to have, at the Andre Emmerich Gallery on West 57th Street, and I went. And when I walked in that gallery and saw these incredible incredible, huge, emblematic, colorful paintings on the walls. It was as if my own aesthetic was shown to me. It really was a life-changing encounter with those paintings and with her, because from the very beginning, she was so genuinely supportive and encouraging of what I wanted to do, and we became friends. And over the course of more than 30 years until her death in 2011, we remained friends, and she has allowed me to use all of her paintings, her visual images for the covers of my 6 recordings for Naxos, so that has meant a great deal to me. So when comes time to write the piano concerto for Jeffrey, and I had been thinking about 3 Frankenthaler paintings that I really liked, I put the 3 of them together. The first, Spiritualist, that's the name of the painting, and that's the name of the first movement of the concerto. And then the second painting and name of the second movement, Silent Wish. And then the third is called Natural Answer. And so somehow that little haiku-like progression of Spiritualist, Silent Wish, Natural Answer made sense to me as a musical idea, as an emotional trajectory that I wanted to express in music. And using her paintings, those 3 paintings, as my response to them, as a kind of emotional wellspring from which to draw my own musical ideas.
All right, interesting. With this deep, obviously, you know, personal and emotional connection that you have with, you know, the visual art medium, I wanted to ask about your husband, Chris von Rosenvinge. I understand this April you'll be coming up on the 40 years of being together, so I want to give you an early congratulations there. And he works in the arts as a graphic designer, obviously a very different art form, but I'm curious about whether or how you, these two very different art forms, do you inspire each other's work? Do you ever work collaboratively? Or
Chris was actually the one who introduced me to Helen's work. We had been together 2 years, maybe not even quite, in the early 80s, and we were in our apartment on West 71st Street, and this television special called Toward a New Climate, Helen Frankenthaler, came on Channel 13, and I don't know why, I just kind of instinctively reached over and started to change the channel. I wasn't sure I was going to be interested. And he said, no, wait a minute, I want to watch that. And I think you should too. And we did. And it's a half-hour program. And by the end of that program, as I said, that was the it moment. So I'm always grateful to Chris and credit him for being the person who first introduced me to Helen's work. And over the years, Chris has a wonderful, he's very well-educated, well-read, and he's a wonderful graphic designer. He's very adept at electronic media design in music and the arts. He designs my own website, plus many others for other artists. But because he's also a musician by avocation, we really had a lot of connections and things we were interested in together, not only music, but visual art and literature. And over the years, we've certainly shared all these things. He has, in fact, designed all of the disc booklets, the jewel box design, for all of my recordings for Naxos and 2 of my others for a different label. But the point is, you know, we've always found a way to share our mutual interests in what we each do, but the things that we love together. So I'm extremely grateful for that, and certainly grateful for the celebration on April 28th of 40 years.
Yes, again, congratulations there. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, Grammy Award-winning composer, conductor, and educator Kenneth Fuchs. His piano concerto will be performed this Sunday evening by the Punagorda Symphony in a concert featuring pianist Jeffrey Beagle. Sunday's program also includes Dvorak's From the New World, Symphony No. 9, and Shostakovich's Festive Overture. For more information about the concert, visit pgsymphony.org. And for more information about today's guest, visit his website, kennethfuchs.com. Both Jeffrey Beagle and Kenneth Fuchs will join me on stage for the final pre-concert edition of Musical Conversations and the Punagorda Symphony's current classical concert series. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Cinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm John Davis. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.